Hi, this is Amira Adao, your host of Beauty and Wellness Talk. This is a podcast that we intended to raise awareness on the issues of skin lighting, chemical exposures, and the health and well-being and empowering communities. We interview different individuals around the issues of colorism, skin lighting practices, and chemical exposures. And so if you are listening to us, thank you so much. And please subscribe to our podcast and share with others. So as part of our continuous discussion on colorism and learning about how colorism impacts communities of color and the lived experience of colorism, today I get the opportunity to interview Dr. Ronald Hall, who's a professor and have done extensive work and research in the issue of colorism. So Dr. Hall, welcome to the podcast, Beauty and Wellness Talk. Can you introduce yourself?
Thank you very much. As mentioned, my name is Dr. Ronald E. Hall. Currently, I'm a professor in the School of Social Work at Michigan State University. I've been studying the issue of skin color and bleaching for about 25 or 30 years now. It was the topic of my dissertation. And when I started my work, pretty much there weren't many people studying this issue. It was kind of considered an exotic topic. But what I found in my dissertation was that there was a correlation between skin color, income, education, and occupation, such that the lighter complected an American is, the more money they'll make, the more education they will have, and they'll likely have a more prestigious occupation. About 6 months after I finished my dissertation, I got a call from an attorney in Atlanta, Georgia. And I wound up being the expert witness for America's first case of colorism in the case of Marmol versus the Internal Revenue Service, Atlantic Federal District Court. And in that case involved an African-American woman who was lighter complected, and she sued her supervisor at the Internal Revenue Service, who was darker complected, on the basis of discrimination. The judge found by the end of the case that the plaintiff did not prevail, but in fact, based upon the testimony that I had given, I had proven that colorism does in fact exist. About 2 years later, I co-authored with Midge Wilson and Kathy Russell the widely read The Color Complex, The Last Taboo Among African Americans. Subsequent to that book, I then devised something that I had been thinking about for years, but I had never collected the data on it. And the theoretical construct that I devised is called the bleaching syndrome, which addresses the idea that women of color who have to assimilate in a Eurocentric environment idealize light complexions that they don't have. So they use these bleaching creams to reach that ideal. But the critical point I want to make about that, people think because this issue is normally associated with African Americans or persons of African descent, that it's an issue peculiar to that population, and it's not. So after writing the book, it took me about 10 or 12 years, and I began traveling the world. I've not visited every particular country, but I visited every particular major racial population in Africa, Asia, Europe, North and South America, and I've even tested a population on an Indian reservation in North Dakota. So I can say, based on the evidence that I've collected, based on some of the research that others have done, that this is not something peculiar to people of African descent.
That's
it's indicative of all people of color.
Yeah, great point, Dr. Hall. So Before we get into the deeper discussion of the colorism issue, you know, we have maybe listeners that don't understand what it is. As you know, people know so much about racism, but there's so much little awareness around colorism. And so as part of the work that we do is that we raise awareness on this issue and how it's impacting people and also changing the narrative. And so can you describe what is colorism? So people that don't understand the basics of it.
Well, to begin with, I think the public has been misled because the mainstream media, for some reason, is obsessed with race. Race is a contrived theoretical construct that has no basis in biology. So we have the reality of colorism and the fiction of racism. There are books written, any number of journal articles published on race and racism, but colorism and skin color by comparison has been almost totally, totally ignored. Mm-hmm. And maybe that has to do with the fact that it's not something that the Euro-American population is aware of. And so I've encountered people who are scholars, Euro-American scholars. One person, I won't mention her name, but there's a scholar at Harvard. She happens to be Euro-American. She's very good at what she does. She published an excellent, excellent journal article. But she referred to me as the witness for the first case of colorism in America. And that's not true. In fact, I was the expert witness for the first case of colorism in America involving African Americans. And if this professor had done maybe a cursory review of the literature, she would know that the first case that occurred in America, regardless of race, ethnicity, involved Latino Americans in 1980. That was Felix versus Manquez. But because many scholars, Euro-American scholars, do not follow up, are not as diligent as they need to be on this issue, frequently less educated African Americans will know more about the topic than the so-called educated academics. And that's unfortunate.
And why is that, Dr. Hall? Why is that this issue is so under researched, so under raised awareness, and almost unknown? What is the reason?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I celebrate your work so much, is because they simply need to be educated. And it takes people of color to educate the Euro-American population who is still obsessed with race. I've done a couple of lectures at law schools. And since the case that I testified for in 1990, there have been literally hundreds of colorism cases filed in the United States. Mm-hmm. Yet, if I go to law schools, lawyers get no training in this issue. They don't even get a mention of this issue. And you know that the law schools, as is the entire academy, is dominated by Eurocentric perspective. So if that Eurocentric perspective does not incorporate colorism, colorism does not become a reality. These are the journal articles, books written. Mm-hmm. My first book was rejected, The Color Complex, 60 times. But because the iconic writer, Alice Walker, saw the proposal, she endorsed it, then they wanted to publish it. So it's the work that you do and some others who are taking initiative to educate the public and make people aware of this issue. This is the only way it's going to become legitimate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Hall. And that's very sad that, you know, your book even didn't get published. And I totally agree with you on the academia side, whether it's law school or any higher education departments, the lack of awareness, the lack of, even having students read books around colorism.
Yes.
And as you know, colorism is so much embedded in every system
yes.
in the United States. Could
yes.
you talk about a little bit about, you know, the colorism, it's not only limited you know, to the health. It's also embedded in, you know, corruption related issues embedded in education. So could you talk about that?
Well, that's a very good point. I can say that there is no institution in the United States that is not imposed upon by the issue of colorism. Maybe 15 or 20 years ago, in doing my research, I came across a book that was called Uncle Tom's Campus. Uncle Tom's Campus is a book about a white teacher from the state of Wisconsin who traveled south to the state of Georgia to take a position as a teacher. And she noticed that the teachers, that's predominantly black school, black teachers, treated students differently based on their skin color. And she found in writing her book that the black teachers complimented the light-skinned students. They reinforced them, they motivated them, they gave them confidence. They expected the lighter-skinned students to be smarter. The darker-skinned students were all but totally ignored. And this teacher talked to one young man who was very dark-complected, and they thought that he was the worst student in the class. But the fact of the matter is, she found teachers had never talked to him. And after she tutored this student, after she interacted with the student, this white teacher found that this dark-complected student was one of the brightest kids in the class. But because teachers didn't expect him, they had less expectations, that manifested in his academic work. And I would expect that that is recapitulated worldwide. Mm-hmm. When I did my dissertation, yes, I used a projective technique. I asked students, I had about 200 students in my population that I tested. I asked them to project, when you graduate from college, what do you expect to be as a profession? The lighter skinned students, they all expected to be doctors, lawyers, congresspersons, etc. Mm-hmm. The darker complected students expected to be something much less than what their potential suggested they should be. Now, it's okay to be a laborer. It's okay to be a farmer. But if you have the facility to be an engineer or a doctor, mm-hmm. why not? So I know, and I did this study 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when the Dahl studies were taking place in the 40s by Kenneth B. Clark, using 3 and 4 year old girls, comparing white, light-skinned dolls or white dolls with black dolls, the black girls, dark-skinned black girls wanted the light-skinned, the white dolls. And that study has been recapitulated, done over 20 years later, and is finding of no difference.
Yeah, I have seen that story through CNN.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now that you mentioned CNN, I have to get this mentioned CNN. You mentioned about how the public gets misled. People know what I do. So they send me books and journal articles. And one person sent me a schedule for an interview that was going to be done on Nightline, which is a news show that comes on 11 o'clock at night. So they had this Euro-American professor, supposedly a quote-unquote expert, and she made the statement, light-skinned black people have it easy. And it's only dark-skinned black people who have difficulty. No, the fact of the matter is, the public gets misled because you get these definitions. It's always that the darker-complected persons are going to be discriminated against and a lighter-skinned person. The fact of the matter is, dark-complected persons and lighter-complected persons of color are discriminated against, but for different reasons. So if you're darker complected, you're denigrated. And if you're lighter complected, you're told, oh, you're not really black. You're not really African descent. And that is no less stressful than having being denigrated for your skin color. Mm-hmm. But the public media misleads the population by telling them something that simply is not true. So I was lucky enough to appear in Oprah's documentary called Light Girls mm-hmm. to make that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great that you were on that documentary, and that's really important point that you have raised. I get that kind of question a lot, you know, when I talk about the issue of skin lighting practice.
Yes.
Some
Yes.
people ask me about tanning and compare that to tanning, and it's not even the same.
No.
Yeah.
Totally different.
So, yeah.
Totally different.
Different. Yeah. So it's exactly the point that you said now. So do you think, you know, you have seen this 30 years ago, examples of colorism in schools, and that still continues because we do partner with schools and recruit young girls from schools, and that's still continuing that where they're experiencing bullying, color bullying in schools, and that the teachers are not even noticing that. Have you done any work with the schools, and what do you think the solution can be? Because that's where most of the young girls are developing low self-esteem.
Yes.
Yeah.
The only way that you're going to begin to address this issue is, again, getting back to your work. You have to have people go into the schools. Probably first, you need to train teachers. You need to do workshops to train teachers, because particularly if you're talking about a school system that's Euro-American dominated. And I lived in Minneapolis for a couple of years, so I can say from my knowledge that it's mostly Euro-American teachers who dominate the educational system. And that's nothing, I'm not criticizing that. But my point is they bring their experience or what they lack in experience to the school setting. And if they have no idea that this colorism is going on, they not only won't know how to address it, but they won't know that they need to address it. So it continues to be acted out among students. And unfortunately, if no one addresses it, then it gets exacerbated. It gets reinforced. So I think the students need to be educated, but I think we first need to do workshops and trainings with teachers, counselors, and other decision-making bodies in the school system.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the, I'm glad you mentioned about the teachers, and you know, that's a huge representation problem, and that we do know that representation matters and that it's so important to young Black girls and young girls of color. And so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, advocacy around that. You know, I've seen some legislations come through Minnesota legislature where, you know, some of the legislatures are asking increase of teachers of color in public schools. And I think things like that is very important. It gets to the addressing, you know, these kind of issues related to colorism. So your experience, your global experience on colorism, what have you seen other countries, Asia, your travels to Africa and Latin America, and how is that different, the colorism practices in the United States?
Well, first of all, I would say that although people attributed this issue to African Americans, if I am pressed to identify the population where this colorism is most significant, it's not persons of African descent, it's persons from the Asian community. But with the Asian community, tradition normally teaches that that community is closed. So Asian persons will not acknowledge this issue of colorism publicly. They talk about it amongst themselves, but to have that entered into the public domain is to embarrass the family, is to denigrate the family. So rather than talk about it, address it and resolve it, they keep it quiet.
Yeah, so that's not only the Asian communities, that's also African, some African communities where this is very stigma and it's not talked. So it's not limited to the Asian communities.
No doubt. I was going to mention the next population you might look at would be the Latino population or Latinx population.
What
all groups, all populations have in color is they have either been conquered, colonized, or otherwise dominated by Eurocentric populations. So you get people in the Latino community, there's a bit of, I've been watching and reading and researching, there's a bit of a tension going on between Latinx populations and Afro-Latinx populations.
Yes.
If you go to Brazil, for example, where you have the largest population of African-descended people in the Western Hemisphere, 65 million, they refer to themselves as Afro-Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And they have been discriminated against, express discrimination from their lighter-complected Latino brothers and sisters in a public setting. In fact, when my work in Puerto Rico, spent a good amount of time in Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. 70% of the Puerto Rican population identify themselves as white. Mm-hmm. And what I observe, 70% of Puerto Ricans are not white.
Mm-hmm. So it's basically the opposite.
It's the opposite. But you have to understand, these are colonized people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have internalized the Eurocentric norms mm-hmm. of the colonial power structures. That goes for Asia. That goes for Latin America. That also goes, and I was kind of surprised, that goes for African people in South Africa.
Yeah, not only South Africa, Nigeria, East Africa, and other West Africa. So it's all Africa that colorism is like highly embedded in culture.
Yes. The highest rate of skin bleaching in Africa is by Nigerians.
Actually, the world, not only.
Oh, in the world? Africa. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Nigeria, yeah. 77% of Nigerians.
Yes. Women. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
They've been dominated by the British, colonized by the British.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you know, all the countries that have experienced colonization and slavery in the United States,
yes.
is, you know, this is white supremacy ideology. And so
yes.
it's so much embedded in their cultures that if you're light skinned, you are beautiful.
Yes.
So and so that's the other thing, you know, like the work that we do gets into these cultures, like, you know, how do we dismantle, you know, the colonial legacy?
Well, as you mentioned a little earlier, you have to begin to educate the people.
Yeah.
I criticize some of the groups that I mentioned, but I understand, I don't know that they're really at fault. They're just acting out their colonial experience. And if they're not aware of the implications of that colonial experience, then they'll never be advised about the problems of colorism.
Absolutely. And that's why, that's a great point, Dr. Hall. That's why, you know, through the work that we do, Beautiful, especially the podcast, is to actually raise awareness on this issue,
yes.
where, you know, like nobody talks about colorism. And so people to understand, you know, what, you know, the history of this issue, but also how do we uplift them? How do we help them learn about their history and their identity? Because, you know, many people, you know, in many communities lost their identity through these
yes.
parts of colonization
yes.
and slavery.
Yes.
Yeah.
You mentioned what can we do about it. I first began with suggesting that we have workshops and training for teachers, for counselors, for decision makers. The second step is look at curriculum. Because
yeah.
if it's yeah. not taught, if it's not taught as a part of the content for classes, if it's not in some of the textbooks, if they don't get the literature, if they don't get that content and curriculum, then the educational process has not done its job. It's not done its work.
That's a really great point. And so now we're working on the trainers model curriculum. But that is like for, like you were saying, you know, like teachers, like, you know, professionals, but also,
yes.
you know, within communities.
Yes.
We're educating yes. communities so they train, you know, their family members and other community members. But
yes.
your point, that it's a really great point about, you know, school-based curriculums.
Yes.
That really
yes.
get to this. And that's one of the things that I have mentioned to some of our state legislatures, the importance
yes.
of getting to that. And also the books that young people,
yeah.
you know, read. So now, through Beautiful, one of our projects now, we're working on parent toolkit,
mm-hmm.
you know, a toxic-free toolkit, which will include mm-hmm. you know, education fact sheets about toxics in skin lighting, but also we want to include a children book that shows mm-hmm. the presentation of all skin color.
Yes, yes.
And stories that are, you know, in the book is very important because, you know, this is a child and they're reading this very young age. And so how do we actually make sure that they're reading things that promote their own culture and that don't promote colorism?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mentioned curriculum. I think that's an extremely good place to start. And in your activism, what you might consider doing is approaching school boards who make the decisions about the curriculum and what is taught in classes. Now, again, it's about 20, 25 years ago, I approached the University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
I made an attempt to join the School of Social Work there. And I wanted to
professor, as a professor?
As a professor, yes. Mm-hmm. And the director at the time was simply not interested in colorism. I have designed a class on colorism. It's not been adopted anywhere. But my intention was to get them to have a course. Teachers should be required to take that course on colorism. Social workers, any other people involved in the human services industry should have taken, as a part of their education, a class on colorism.
Absolutely. I think, Dr. Hall, you should try that proposal again. And I will absolutely join you on that.
Okay.
And even
okay.
teach that class with you. I think you
okay.
should do that proposal again to the School of Social Work at the University of Minnesota, because that's very important.
I will do that.
Yeah, I think that will help a lot of people, not only social workers, but also other professionals who might take as an elective.
Yes.
Which is very important.
Yes.
So you mentioned, I read your article the other day about many women of color, you know, like in terms of the skin lighting market, buying skin lighting products. Could you say more about that and in your research around that?
Well, what instructors, counselors, teachers, et cetera, should be educated about is something I referred to earlier called the bleaching syndrome. Now, these bleaching creams are indicative of the bleaching syndrome. And as I've been talking for years, the unfortunate problem with a lot of these bleaching creams, as you have mentioned, they are toxic. And they not only contain what I've heard you mention, some toxic substances like mercury, a carcinogen called hydroquinone. Many of them also contain arsenic.
Mm-hmm.
And lead, you can get lead poisoning. When a woman is pregnant, these toxic substances enter the fetus by way of the placenta. And mm-hmm. the result of that is a stillbirth. So mm-hmm. unfortunately, you have women who will put their unborn child's health at risk to exemplify a Eurocentric beauty standard. And I think in any context in the world, that would have to be considered either as having a sickness or certainly dysfunctional. Medical schools teach nothing about this. Law schools teach nothing about this. And the health and well-being of women of color is almost completely ignored where this issue is concerned. But I should also mention, we talk about bleaching creams. In my work in Asia, there's something that's relatively new called glutathione.
Yes.
And glutathione is something that they are injecting in their veins because it gives you a lighter complexion.
And that's a type of skin lighting.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It's an oxidant, antioxidant, so it's healthy for you. But it's not meant to be injected into your veins. If you need to have water, but if you inject water into your veins, it'll probably kill you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the intention is, you know, I mean, when I do research on skin lighting, I look at the intention. So the intention of that approach is to change their skin color.
Yes, yes.
it's still a skin lightening product, whether the person uses for treatment or not. Yes. So it's a type of skin light. And it's not only China. No. I have seen, I was just in Kenya, I've seen people use that, especially those who are higher income celebrities and all. Oh. Yeah. Yes. So so it's another issue, you know, like so it's not only the skin lightening products, but these other things that people are using to change their skin. So in that article you mentioned about the skin lightening marketing, you know, and before, you know, conversations we had, you talked about, you know, the capitalism issue. Could you talk a little bit about that as well?
Well, I know that approaching this issue of bleaching creams is going to be a challenge. And anytime you have the opportunity to make money on a certain issue, a certain product, you're going to probably come up against a lot of challenges. I'm not advocating that we totally make it illegal to sell or to buy bleaching creams. I'm simply saying people need to be educated. And if a person...
Well, we also have to make it illegal so that, you know, the skin lightening education has to be multi-approach, you know. Well, so regulation is very important in this issue.
There are some countries where it has been found to be illegal, but my point is I can spend my best energy. For me to find it illegal would be my choice. Yes, I agree with that, but I don't know that I would have the power to really be effective in making it illegal in every country in the world, which it should be. I'd rather spend my time. I get better results out of my efforts in advocating and educating people about the bleaching creams, and hopefully they'll make the decision on their own.
Absolutely.
And then, and if that happens, then the bleaching cream businesses will go out of business because people are aware of the detrimental effects that they can have.
And absolutely, and we're seeing that, you know, in some communities where, you know, like they actually advocated against it. And you're right, policies in certain countries, they might have policy change, but reinforcing that, you know, and regulating is another case.
And you know that there are some African countries where bleaching creams are illegal. But the result of that illegality is you've created a black market, an underground market. So you can still purchase those creams in those places, but the price shoots up because it's illegal and people still get access. They need to be educated. They need to be educated.
Absolutely. The education and the cultural change, you know, because one of the things that I have noticed throughout the years that I've been working on this is that, you know, you can talk to people as much as you want about, you know, this is bad for your health. But, you know, without getting it to the cultural part, people will not understand. And, and also at the same time, raising you know, the health literacy around chemicals, you know, many, as you know, many of our communities, whether it's here in the United States or globally, they never get equitable health education. And so, so people don't even understand these chemicals, how it's impact the health. And so that's why this issue is multi-approach issue, getting into the culture, addressing the health side, and then, you know, changing these systems that continue to promote colorism.
I think the health side and the educational side are the two most important. The two most important. And they need to be entered into policy, like a policy and law.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like your point about, you know, law school, you know, law schools, not only law schools, like you said, medical schools, they're not teaching these. Schools. And that is, you know, actually this plays out in medical schools. So you have dermatologists in, you know, in clinical settings who are practicing, who don't even know how to treat black skin. Default, they're prescribing skin lightening products, or some of them do sell skin lightening products as a treatment. And so I, in a way, I think some of them are contributing to the issue of skin lighting as well.
And unfortunately, America is so behind. I attended a conference where I did a keynote speech for a dermatological organization in South America, in Suriname, South America.
Mm-hmm.
This is a third world country, but they are abreast of this issue. They attend to it, and they're attempting to do something. But come to America, not only are they not treating people, they don't know that this exists to be treated. And that's no excuse for the largest, the wealthiest country in the world. And we're behind third world developing nations where this issue is concerned. And that's a matter of choice.
It is. That's an excellent point, Dr. Hall. So, Dr. Hall, I want to ask you one more question around colorism and your research and travel to different countries, especially in India.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to hear, because India is one of the countries that has high practice of,
yes,
of skin lighting.
Yes.
Colorism is a highly prevalent issue. And, you know, because of the caste system, could you talk about, you know, the caste system and the colorism?
Yes. India was not a country early on, although we think of it as being one nation. It is one nation today. And when people think about skin color and colorism in India, they normally attribute it to British occupation.
Mm-hmm.
But the British left, who colonized India, the British left India in about 1940, 49. Supposedly the caste system is illegal. But this issue of colorism didn't begin in India with the British. The Indians were first colonized or invaded by peoples called Aryans. Aryans were lighter complected invaders in India, and they are responsible for creating the caste system. And it just so happens the highest castes, who are referred to as Brahmins,
mm-hmm,
they are associated with lighter complexion. There are some Brahmins who you will find that are darker complected. But when you think of Indian society and the caste society, typically those upper caste persons are going to be lighter complected. Mm-hmm. Now your lower caste persons, which might include a group called the Dalits. Mm-hmm. And I work with a professor at Harvard named Suraj, who is a Dalit Indian. And we've done work on this issue of colorism among Dalits in India. Many of them are highly discriminated against. There are some Dalits,
mm-hmm,
such as a man by the name of Akbar, who are lighter complected.
Mm-hmm.
But when we think about the Dalits, or sometimes they're called untouchables, mm-hmm, frequently they are darker complected. And there have been cases where women who are darker complected are treated horribly. Women who are darker complected have suffered from cases of murder, cases of harassment. And it's difficult if a darker complected woman is assaulted to get justice from the court system, particularly if it's a higher caste, lighter complected assailant.
Mm-hmm.
And the Aryans go back before India was a country. And unfortunately, this issue of colorism has been going on for centuries. I can't even guess how long. I will say that India, of all my travels, India is the most socially complex society in the world. You got class, you got caste, you got education, you got religion, you got race. Extremely complex.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing to be consistent across all striations of Indian culture is this issue of complexion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at most of your Indian leaders, they're lighter complected persons. And I must say, there has been some recent pushback on the part of some of your Indian activists and some of particularly your entertainers in what they call Bollywood.
Mm-hmm.
They have begun to try to address this issue of colorism, and they've been trying to address the disadvantages that darker complected Indians have. So there is some change.
Yeah, there is absolutely some change. Yeah, I have seen some Indian celebrities who used to advertise the skin lighting product is now apologizing like what they have done. So absolutely, it's slowly changing.
I want to say, I want to make a correction about something I said. I said the name Akbar. The actual name is Ambedkar. Mm-hmm. Ambedkar was a lighter complected Indian man who is given his historical stature in India. He happens to be a Dalit, which is the very lowest. He was educated at Columbia here in the U.S. He helped write the Indian Constitution, and he is considered a hero, particularly among Dalits. But he was not what you would consider your dark, very dark complected Indian. And in my travels in India, I've encountered Indians who were darker complected than most African Americans, mm-hmm. very dark.
Yeah.
And they suffer.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Hall, for sharing that. So the question that also I want to ask you is that, and that I asked everyone that I interviewed through the podcast focusing on colorism, what's your lived experience of colorism? Because, you know, we all have lived experience. And so that's why we do the work that we do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting that you should ask, because I've thought about that myself on occasion. I come from what would be referred to as a mixed race family. I'm descended from Europeans, Africans, and what's called Cherokee Indians. Mm-hmm. And my father was half Cherokee. So if you saw a picture of my father, you wouldn't think he was Black. You would think he was probably Latino.
Mm-hmm.
But I have relatives who look white, who look Black, and everything in between. There was never, that I know of, there was never any issues around colorism in my family. Mm-hmm. So I can't look at my personal experience as being the reason why I've been so interested in this topic. I always think that maybe looking back, it had something to do with my father communicating this issue to me without ever mentioning a word about it. Because he was always getting comments from people, which didn't bother me. It bothered him. What are you? So he married a Black woman who was very African-esque, dark-complected, so people could look at his wife and look at his children and never have to ask the question, what are you? And he was very much more into his Black ancestry, his Black history. He had all the books. My mother took her Blackness for granted because she was very dark complected and obviously Black. My father, he had to always prove himself Black.
Mm-hmm.
And my sisters and brothers were all very consistent medium tone. But I think there was some message communicated to me, again, without it ever coming up in discussion, that this was an issue. And I'm really surprised, amazed that for 25 or 30 years that I have maintained the interest that I have in this topic. That kind of surprises me, because I read more, I research more, that brings up more questions. So then I need more answers.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's really great. And thanks for sharing your family history and your lived experience.
Thank you.
That's really great. And it's important for people to hear that everybody's lived experience. My last question to you is that, you know, as we talked about, you know, the issue of colorism and skin lighting practices is hugely impacting communities of color, especially their health and well-being. So people who will be listening to you in this podcast, what advice do you have for them? Those who are experiencing colorism, or those who don't have lived experience, but we want them to learn about this issue.
Well, if you don't have lived experience, you need, again, to follow the work of people like yourself, the books and journal articles that are written on this topic. But I would say, particularly to communities of color, I think we need to air the dirty laundry, get this out in the open. Because as I study and I research colorism, I know that educating the people about it is important, but I also know that it's potentially a very explosive, divisive issue. We need to address this and stop light-skinned people, stop pointing fingers at dark-skinned people, and dark-skinned people stop pointing fingers at light-skinned people. You need to know and reinforce the idea that you have cultural, racial, ethnic similarities, and your complexion does not define you as more Black or less than Black.
Mm-hmm. That's a really great advice. Loving everybody and loving your skin.
Yes.
That's really important. And it's really important, I agree, people to embrace who they are, regardless of what skin color.
Yes.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hall. This was really great. It has been really great talking to you and learning from you over the years. So thank you so much.